Hello and welcome to the France 24 debate. I'm Annette Young, filling in for Francois Picard. Now, here's a fact for you. Every 10 minutes last year, a woman somewhere in the world was killed by a person close to her, while some 50,000 women and girls were killed by intimate partners or family members in 2024. These figures having been released by the UN as we mark the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women and Girls. The UN decrying a lack of progress in the battle against femicide. So how do we get the message across that violence against women and girls is indeed a men's issue, particularly against the backdrop as the rise of AI continues and as a result is resulting in intensified digital abuse being directed at women? I'll be talking about this with my panel in a moment, but first, James Vezina has this report on toxic masculinity.
While toxic masculinity isn't new, as it came about in the 1980s in North America, it's gaining attention and appealing to some younger men today. Those relaying its ideas say that they're oppressed and are losing out as gender equality progresses. A report by France's High Council for Equality Between Women and Men has warned about the issue in the country.
There is a polarisation happening among some young people. On one side, there are women embracing feminism. On the other, there are men who are adopting harsh sexist ideas promoted by those who spread toxic masculinity, as well as reactionary and politicised movements.
The report states that 45% of men under the age of 35 believe that it's difficult to be a man in today's society. And that includes a 19% increase among 15 to 24-year-olds over the past 2 years. Meanwhile, 13% of 25 to 34-year-olds believe that being a man is difficult, but being a woman is easy. And these ideas are leading to a change in attitudes. Still among men under the age of 35, 53% think it's important to know how to fight, and 46% believe that it's wrong to show their emotions. The council has advised that an awareness programme be put in place for all young people. It says that it should educate them about respecting others and preventing sexist and sexual violence.
And joining me today is Natasha Henry, a French journalist specialist on gender-based violence from Vienna, Professor Julie Pizzetti, the director of the Information Integrity Initiative at Maria Ressa's digital forensic lab, The Nerve, and also chair of the Centre for Journalism and Democracy at City University of London. Also in the studio with me is Dipti Chanda, president of EMMA, a French NGO promoting diversity in technology and a consultant with Google. And from Lausanne in Switzerland, Jan Michalko, a research fellow in gender equality and social inclusion at ODI Global. I'm going to start by asking all of the panellists this question, and I'll start with you first, Natasha. Why do men consistently fail to see that violence against women and girls is indeed a men's issue?
First of all, thank you for having me. These statistics, the polls, did not exist 10 years ago or when I was 15, so we don't know whether those figures are new or are showing anything new. So I think we should be careful about this. I don't think there's a division between men and women when it comes to violence against women, democratic men, normal men, nice men, intellectual men, clever men, whatever, nice people are on the side of the victims. But there is a trend for this toxic masculinity because of all these people sitting behind their computers and thinking it's fun to just insult and threaten women and having this sort of movement that is only possible because of the internet.
Julie Pizzetti in Vienna, may I ask you, why do you think there's a sort of a blank spot in terms, or a blind spot rather, with men when it comes to the issue of women's violence against women?
Well, I do think that the research indicates that we are actually in a much worse situation as a result of the weaponization of technology, which has in effect allowed for the networked nature of misogyny. And it's also leading to an increase in sexist attitudes and misogynistic behaviours among young men in particular by comparison to previous generations of younger men. We've seen research in the UK, for example, indicating that while young women become less conservative and are more likely to identify with feminism, young men are more likely to express the kinds of attitudes that your report just demonstrated. And so-called influencers, toxic male influencers like Andrew Tate, for example, and his brother, are part of the problem. So what we see is the use of technologies and the failure of big tech companies to install guardrails that protect users from rampant and networked misogyny, which works as a form of fuel, if you like, for the kinds of physical violence and sexual harassment, all sorts of offline harms that women have experienced, you know, for eternity. So there's a sort of supercharge of this, you know, abuse and harassment and violence as a result of the mainstreaming of digital technologies.
Dipti, given that you've worked in the tech community and there's still very much that tech bro culture, with your NGO, how do you change attitudes?
Yeah, thank you for the question. I think it's a huge debate that we have on how we bring inclusion in STEM and in technology. AI, I would say we are in a momentum where AI is taking more and more places in every field other than its technology is in medical sector, in wherever sector, education sector. With Emma, we have been fighting since 15 years now on how do we bring more inclusion in technology, and this has to do with education. We talk a lot about the fact that there isn't enough inclusion in technology, but before bringing inclusion, we also need to give the technical skills at the earlier age. So then everyone should feel included, and we would avoid those biases that we have today in AI, which is, of course, the reality in tech.
I want to come back to you on that point because a lot of the tech community seem to struggle with the notion or the concept of regulation. But let me also now talk to Jan, dare I say, as our sole male representative on this panel. Why do you think men fail to see violence against women and girls as a men's issue?
I think there are maybe two elements to that. I think one is that through the narratives that we use, we often fail to name the perpetrators. So when we speak about gender-based violence, we often do not say that it's male violence against women. And I think that has underplayed the role that men, of course, play in that. And tied to that is, of course, that gender is often associated with, falsely, of course, with women and being a women's issue. I think often men do not think about themselves as gendered beings. And I think as a result, it fails us to see the responsibility and the active role that men play in the violence. So I think there is definitely need to clearly articulating this and shifting the discourse and therefore also recognizing the responsibility. And maybe just a final point with regards to recognizing men as gendered beings, of course, is to see that a system of gender norms that are kind of very prescriptive and create this set of expectations of what it means to be a man in the society are, of course, harmful for women, harmful for men. And therefore, I think creating that connection to the system, the oppressive patriarchal system, would enable more of us to see the connection and the role that we play in the issue.
Julie, you've carried out extensive research in recent years on how women journalists have been targeted by online abuse. Can you explain how this epidemic of violence goes way beyond the digital world and often transforms into physical violence, and what it means for society as a whole?
Sure, and our recent research is actually focused on not just journalists, but human rights defenders and activists and writers and communicators of other forms. And that research is being produced as I speak for UN Women. And the picture is incredibly bleak. It's getting worse. And so a study that I led for UNESCO between 2019 and 2022 focused on the experiences of women journalists online, found that then 73% of women journalists globally had experienced online violence, as we refer to it, in the course of their work. Really alarmingly, one-fifth, 20% of those women said they'd experienced offline abuse, harassment, and attacks that they believed had been seeded online. So the point is that online violence is real. There's nothing, you know, fake about it. There's nothing purely digital about it. It does not stay online. And the risk escalates when women are targeted in ways that also radiate to their family members, for example, which is something that we see frequently. And while I can't share the figures with you from this research that will be published by UN Women at the end of the month, what I can tell you is that the situation is substantially worse when it comes to the issue of online violence manifesting itself through offline harm. So this trajectory from online to offline is seriously worrying. And the function of AI, in particular generative AI here, is notable.
And that's what I want to pick up on, because Dipti, AI has seen the emergence of pornographic deep fakes, AI girlfriends, even cyber brothels. And as a result, schools gripped with an epidemic of online sexual abuse. I mean, AI is truly reinventing misogyny, is it not?
So I think I'm very optimistic about technology, because I meet myself as an engineer. I am really in a position where I think AI should be more and more regulated. And Europe has a good key in its hands, because we impose many regulation. And I think maybe Europe will be a situation or a solution where we could challenge on how AI should be regulated, what should be the norms, what are the concerns, and how we make sure that it doesn't create everything we see around, you know, violence, and AI is acting for only a certain people, not for others. So those has to do also with the work that we all put into that. And I'm very optimistic, to be honest, on if we create that, we definitely can.
You say you're optimistic, but there's a lot of people in your industry who would not share your views.
I agree. I know. And that's why it is important. The work we're doing with Emma is we put, in fact, in front of the uncomfortable situations where we face daily with AI, and NGOs and government play a big role in putting those efforts toward to make AI as much regulated as we can.
Natasha, as somebody who's lived and worked in France for a very long time, we had the Gisele Pellicot case last year. You know, we've had the fallout from Me Too and the arts community. I mean, now when you look at attitudes in this country alone, when it comes to addressing women's violence, we've got a socialist MP this week who's introduced draft legislation to cover all areas of dealing with gender-based violence, and the overall aim to tackle the issue of impunity. I mean, impunity is a big problem, isn't it, when it comes to addressing gender-based violence?
Yes, and I believe that when they are provoking all this violence behind their computers, it's even better for their impunity, and it's even more comfortable for them. However, I really want to be optimistic, like my colleague here. Whenever there is something coming up on your phone or on your computer, I'm more specialized in domestic violence. So that's what we say to the victims, or in sexual harassment cases, keep everything and go to the police, or go to a women's association, or go to somebody you trust, and go and keep all this. Because the good thing about all this is that they leave traces. I mean, it's all there in your computer. So you can actually prove that what you are saying is true. The Petit Court case is far away from artificial intelligence.
But you're dealing
But the police officer who did open that phone and think, there's something here that doesn't seem quite right. And he opened the app Snapchat on Monsieur Pellicot's phone, and then he found a whole world of horrible messages. And this is how we got the Pellicot trial.
Having said that, of course, he was going online to recruit strangers to have sex with his drugged wife. So, you know, it does all come back to the use of the online platforms as such.
And on that, if I may, I agree with what Natasha is saying. This is basically a case where education play really a key role. When I talk about education, I'm not saying books and schools. I'm saying giving the knowledge on how you navigate safely online. And this start at the earlier age.
Julie, artificial intelligence, as we were just saying, has taken and amplified digital violence to a whole other level. I mean, how dangerous is it for women, especially those in high-profile positions or positions of power these days? What sort of examples have you come across during your research?
Just wanted to say one thing in response to the point about police work, like law enforcement and the judiciary. One of the things that is a constant challenge for women, particularly women journalists or human rights defenders, women political actors who are seeking redress, which they cannot get at all from big tech companies, which are now, you know, run by members of what has become known as the broligarchy, you know, which demonstrates just how much misogyny and big tech power have converged. But one of the problems that they face when trying to get action on the justice side is that there is, an extreme lack of digital forensics capabilities, or even just a lack of awareness that digital violence is real world violence. You know, there's nothing virtual about it. And I think one of the challenges that we have is appreciating that online violence really aids and abets impunity for crimes against women journalists and women in public life more broadly, and women in general, because it normalizes, you know, the state of violence and misogynistic hate speech, is further weaponized. But we have seen some horrific cases, and One of the important things to point out is that this is a genuinely global problem. It is not something that is the preserve of states where misogyny is rooted in governance, for example, although arguably that's a global phenomenon too. One of the more frightening cases actually involves a journalist called Patricia Devlin from Northern Ireland, who was reporting on organised crime and militia in Northern Ireland, and who during the pandemic had the police who did actually appreciate in her instance that, in her case, that this was a serious risk to her life. She received credible death threats, not just to her, but she received a threat via Facebook Messenger that her daughter, her infant child, would be raped, and that they knew where the child was being cared for by the journalist's grandmother and named the address. And this prompted the police to treat her situation quite seriously. But in her case, sort of online threats that she had experienced had really morphed very powerfully offline. For example, there was graffiti on a wall in Belfast with her name and the sights of a gun, and referencing some of her reporting. And she was falsely accused, which is where you see gender disinformation also being a feature of these sorts of attacks, falsely accused of herself being associated with organized crime. So that's one example. There are other examples, including false reports of a woman journalist in Sri Lanka, for example, being dead, where her family was informed with material that allegedly proved that she'd died. She had not, in fact, died. What we're seeing, though, with generative AI is, as I said, this sort of supercharging of the risk environment and the threats. Because now perpetrators can very easily and quickly, much more so, produce very cheaply, much more believable and much more effective abusive material. So this is the scenario we're faced with.
And with that in mind, let me bring in Jan. I mean, how do you address something like that? I mean, the difficulties of policing such information. I mean, it is exceedingly tough because in the world of online abuse, there are no borders, are they?
Yes, absolutely. And I would just echo what was said in terms of seeing this as a global problem, and also echo the need for regulation for sure. But I think it also behests us to think that the connection between the offline and online worlds mean that a lot of the interventions to prevent this violence actually start, for example, with addressing some of the existing social norms that are in the society, and where the violence that we see is actually a way of enforcing these inequalities. For example, with regards to politics, as we heard, the online violence is a means of suppressing women's participation in politics. It is about maintaining status quo and maintaining people, especially men, in positions of power. And of course, if we bring that intersectional lens as well, when we understand that, of course, women of color, women from the queer community, for example, are facing even harsher and more vile forms of abuse, it means that we really do need to start thinking about the solutions early on. And I would echo what Dipti was saying also with regards to education here, where it is one of those spaces where we can make very early on interventions to kind of stop the root causes of some of these horrible forms of violence.
And Jan, one of the spillover effects of all this is we're now witnessing a gender divide in a political sense like never before, where consistently both research and election results show that younger women under the age of 30 take a far more progressive stance on issues such as immigration or gender issues, while their male peers are becoming that much more conservative and feeding into support for the far right. I mean, how do we educate our youth to stop this political and social polarisation?
Absolutely. I think it is a worrying trend in some parts of the world, for sure. And I think it is definitely a call to action for policymakers to make those investments, for example, in the education space, where we, for example, do much more think about what does it mean to have critical digital literacy skills to be fit for the modern world and for the online lives that people lead these days. I think part of the critical literacy skill set is, of course, to critically challenge and question the content that, for example, certain influencers are putting out there, which are weaponizing, as I mentioned, the existing norms, but that are also weaponizing some structural issues and inequalities that men and women are facing. You know, I think, for example, challenges with employment and long-term austerity measures that we have seen in many parts of the world are creating really difficult circumstances for a lot of people. But then it is the online misogynists who are falsely blaming feminism, gender equality, women's rights for some of these challenges that actually lie at the feet of policymaking. And so I think part of that critical literacy, working with young people, is to kind of question the sources of this information, the narratives that are behind it, and the true causes behind some of those challenging experiences that they have. And maybe just if I may add at the end, you know, there is luckily a lot of evidence of good practices of what works to engage in these conversations, to bring young people to, and especially men, to the table and to the conversation, because you know, feminists and pro-feminist men have been working on transforming these masculine norms for many years. And so, for example, we know that bringing in the education sector young people to conversation that is very relevant to their lives, using examples from their daily realities to make them, for them, visible what gender actually means and looks like, and why is it harmful for them and for people around them, can definitely be a starting point.
Dipti, again, what can you do in your particular sector, and what are you doing to address these very hard-baked, hard-wired cultural attitudes that we are all dealing with?
Yes, and I agree with what was said. I think we did a couple of, you know, formative through workshops where we meet those young and we talk about the importance of having an inclusion in any sector, in workplace, and so on. And we see there is a mindset, a shift, because you have open conversation on about, I would say, opposite visions, which need to be fight on transparently, and then we'll end up in a right direction. And that's exactly what Jin was mentioning right now. One thing which I wanted to also highlight is that we were talking about regulation. We see more and more AI content produced on the internet. We don't know sometimes if it's real or not, if those videos or those images are real or not. And regulation play really a key role here. And plus, we have more and more what we call in the tech world, it's a wording which says you can activate the option that is able to confirm you if it is an AI content produced or it's a human content produced. I think those things need to be educated by telling at the young age, saying them, you could know if this content is real or not by reviewing the watermark. This is the typically how we say in the tech world. And of course, we need to address that with the government support, because we cannot go and meet those young people. I mean, we need to scale this because AI is being used globally. And how we should scale this, we need the support of people all around the world, and basically government play a key role in that.
Julie, 1.8 billion women are said to be not legally protected from digital violence, yet governments at the best of times are playing catch up with technological advances. So what can be done at a legislative front? And what Dipti was talking about, is that enough?
So, yeah, I mean, a couple of things. It's important, I suggest, that we acknowledge that presidents, prime ministers, political actors are actually among the top perpetrators of gender-based online violence, according to our research and others. So there's a real problem here with a lack of political will, and certainly with the rise in authoritarianism, where misogyny is a central plank of an authoritarian playbook. It's becoming even more difficult to get the kind of regulatory and legislative response that we need, particularly when President Donald Trump is protecting his big tech allies in Silicon Valley, who have, to the point that one of your guests was just raising, rolled back safety and trust teams, which have actively discourage the development of guardrails, as they're known, with regard to generative AI tools in the arms race that is what AI is all about. You know, the chasing of obscene profits at the expense of the safety and well-being of women and girls and minorities all over the world. And you know, when just look at the sort of scenario that we now have, where OpenAI has announced several weeks ago that it is going to siphon up all of the content of Pornhub, so that among the large language model bases for the generative AI results will be unlimited amounts of Pornhub material, which is terrifying to think of. And this sort of highlights the ways in which you know, the creation of deepfakes and cheapfakes, all sorts of disinformational content focused on the sexualization of women, and sometimes the violent sexualization of women, it really is terrifying. I'm sorry, I struggle to be optimistic in the context where we have a limited an amount of political will, where we've rolled back the progress we were making, where in fact the weaponization of technologies and the willful manipulation of technologies and the failure of big tech companies to address these issues is facilitating the rollback of gender rights more broadly. You know, so what we can do, though, is hold the line in the EU. That is not happening. I'm seeing really worrying signs from the European Commission, you know, with regard to EU legislation. So protections that are embedded within GDPR, for example, so privacy-preserving legislation. Other protections that are about, you know, ensuring that women can be defended against hate speech that is technology facilitated. These sorts of protections must be reinforced, and there needs to be an end to the capitulation to pressure coming from the White House on these issues.
Natasha, your thoughts?
Well, of course, I agree with what has been said. It is very worrying. I would call for censorship, just you know, and more women in tech and more regulations, and put pressure on our MPs and governments and the European Union. The problem is that that system doesn't have borders. So, of course, we need regulations that deal with these invisible borders.
Jan, you know, the problem also is that in most realms of political leadership, we're not only dealing with men, but we're dealing with men from an analog generation who really still struggle with digital technology and how this plays out in terms of promoting violence against women and girls. Again, it's not a case of just educating our youth, but it's about educating all of us, is it not?
Absolutely. I think we definitely need to work to bring more men in positions of power onto the gender equality agenda, because I completely agree with what has been said, that the lack of political will is one of the key obstacles. We were lucky for some years in the recent past where we did have men who in politics who stepped up and at least committed themselves to gender equality agenda, who, you know, even maybe at some points proudly declared themselves to be feminist. And we at ODI did some research into understanding, you know, how can we bring more men into this space and to create allyship in those highest levels of politics. Because some men in these positions, of course, are the perpetrators of this violence. And so we need people with positions of power who are willing to counter that. And so I think one of the some of the strategies that work in this context is, of course, to bring more men into community with other role models, other men who have done this work, to push, to move beyond kind of rhetorical commitments to feminism and gender equality, and of course push for specific actions that sometimes is lacking behind that rhetoric. Certainly, civil society plays a huge role in motivating this change and to bring more men into gender equality work. And so I think part of the worrying trend now that we're seeing is the cutting back of funding for civil society and feminist movements in particular. So I think there's definitely a lot that we need to be doing to support the kind of bottom-up demand for our political leaders to, as was said, hold the line and to step up into these spaces, because it is based on their political calculation. They would be more willing and interested, of course, to take up gender equality if they felt that it is part of their political agenda and career. And so that lies on civil society and for that bottom-up pressure.
Deputy, given what Jan and Julie have been saying, it's about holding the line, and Julie is saying she's anything but optimistic. You work in an industry which, again, I'm stressing, is not renowned for its love of regulation. It's predominantly led by men, white men of a certain class. So how can someone like yourself and others change that culture?
I just want to go back on what Julie said and you as well. I know it's not enough just doing those, I would say, awareness sessions. Being myself in tech and I am not white, as you can all see, the path was very, I would say, difficult. Having Indian origins plus being a woman is not easy in technology. But I think all of us mentioned a good point is role model. And this is where I fight since years on saying to anyone is that you have the place to go into tech and you should take the opportunity. And people also coming from rural areas. I mean, we need role models, but we need role models that represent our society. And technology doesn't have it yet. Very few, but we still need to continue. I cannot just say, because we don't have it, we should stop it. Otherwise, we will amplify all the issues that we talk about since an hour now. I think it's a good way to see that there is a problem, but now how do you solve that? And keep on solving, because at some point people like me or some others need to land in those high level positions that Jan was mentioning, where they can bring the change and challenge those leaders which might not be on the same path as we do.
Julie, is there anyone who's listening to what you and others in your field are saying? Are there any role models as such in terms of political leaders who understand the depth of this problem and are wanting to do whatever they can to implement regulations in order to stop this tidal wave of online violence?
I mean, very few, unfortunately. I would name Jacinda Ardern, the former Prime Minister of New Zealand, as somebody who has both experienced gender-based online violence and extremism as one who gets it. I mean, there is some evidence that the President of France, Macron, understands these issues and has made moves to try and lead some of the work in the EU context. But one of the things that Jacinda Ardern works on that I think we could build on is the connection between digital communities and violent extremism. And one of the missing points of understanding here is that misogyny, networked misogyny, needs to be understood as a form of potential violent extremism. So we need a security lens here. And I wonder if that might actually be more effective in pushing political leaders to act against the sort of and against this crisis of networked misogyny, which is having very significant offline impacts. We see the radicalization of young men being pushed towards extremist behaviors, being pushed further into the right-wing, fascist sort of rabbit holes of the internet. And if we can understand the connection between that kind of misogynistic hate and radical behaviors, including violent extremism, then perhaps we can actually start to treat this issue with the seriousness that it deserves, instead of continuing to sweep it under the carpet as an issue that is only about women and that just affects women.
Jan, what do you say to what Julie just said?
I completely agree, and I think there is definitely a stronger case we ought to be making about this being a question of democracy. I mean, this is about protecting democracy. You know, women's political representation, for example, is a key democratic issue about inclusion and equality. And so if, as a result of the online violence, gender-based violence that women experience, are either not entering politics at all or withdrawing, as we saw in some of the recent elections, we have a democratic concern on our hands. And I think, similarly to what Julie was saying, I think you know, the connections between online misogyny, but also tied to conversations around immigration and the racism that we're experiencing there, and the general move to far right, makes gender for, and has for many years actually made gender this kind of canary in the coal mine, where when we are seeing the rollback on the rights of women and queer people, we are going to be seeing much more of a decline of democracy overall. So I think it's for those people who might not see it as a major political agenda for themselves, I think seeing it in this light should bring up their attention to gender-based violence online much more.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for, so I want to thank my guests tonight. That is Professor Julie Prosetti, Natasha Henry, Dipti Chander, and of course Jan Michalko. Again, you can watch this debate online on france24.com. That's it for now, and until tomorrow evening, thank you. Do stay with us here on France 24.